All right, welcome to the latest edition of the Positive Populist Podcast. There you go, I got it out all correctly. And here's our guest. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Rob Smith. I am America's favorite black gay Republican.
Okay, well, there's so much to talk about there. America's favorite black gay Republican.
Lot to unpack.
Before we get to that, Rob, the question I always open with, are you a positive populist?
I would like to think that I'm a positive populist. I would like to think that there's an element of motivation and, uh-huh. and self-help in everything that I say and everything that I do when it comes to politics and the world around us.
So you're saying you're going with the positive part. Is that what I'm hearing there? You like that?
I like being positive, absolutely.
Great. And then what does it mean? But you weren't kind of immediate. You know, some people ask that question. I mean, it's just a nice way to get the conversation going, really, because it's interesting. Some people say, yeah, I am. I love it. You know.
Yeah.
And then other people say, well, I kind of maybe. I don't know. So I'm just interested what it means to you when you hear that phrase. What's going through your head?
When I hear that phrase, you know, positive is obviously positivity, but populist means somebody that is of the people and for the people.
Yeah.
And even though I've done, you know, a lot of great things and amazing things and continue to get a lot of amazing opportunities, I'm still of the people because I am from Akron, Ohio.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm a Midwest guy. I'm of the people, and that's where the populist comes for me.
Okay, so you basically approve of that label.
I do.
Okay, good. Because, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people don't, you know, that's in funny, you know, that's a part of what I'm trying to do is say this thing, this movement, whatever you want to call it, populism, which, you know, at various times has been applied to the right, to the left, to Donald Trump, to Brexit, but also to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, they get called populists as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great conversation with Tammy Bruce, just in exactly sitting right where you are now, when she's saying, well, basically, if you're on the left, you can't be a populist because it's all about power to the people. That's really what populism is about. It's about the people having power, the people having control. And the left don't want that. They want to centralize power. They want to take power away from people. Anyway, whatever.
And put it in the hands of the government.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, anyway, whatever. We'll get into that. But let's now go back to your very kind of, you know, you really kind of laid it out there.
Yeah,
America's
laid it out.
America's favorite black gay Republican. Where do you want to start with that?
God, where do I want to start with that? I could go back to Ohio, and I'm also a military veteran as well.
Right.
I could talk a little bit about that. I can talk about why I made the decision to come out as a conservative Republican about a year and a couple of months back.
Right.
You know,
most people, when they say come out, you know, when you're talking about story, who are gay, they're mostly, it's about them coming out as gay. But
yeah.
When did one happen and when did the other happen?
Well, I came out when I was gay. So I joined the military right out of high school. So I was 17 years old, from Akron, Ohio. Parents had never gone to college. Mm-hmm. I was a first-generation college student, but I needed to get out of Akron, Ohio. I wanted to go into the military. I wanted to serve my country. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to do all that.
Yeah.
Now, I served in the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which meant that I could not be openly gay and serve in the military. Otherwise, I'd get kicked out. So when I finished the 4 years plus a year of reserves that I did, I was done with closets. And so that's when I came out. So I came out right after the military.
So when was that?
I came out when I exited the military. I exited the military in early 2005.
And how old were you then?
I was about 23.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I exited the military. I came out because I was just done with closets. Mm-hmm. So that was the coming out as gay.
And how, just before we move on from that,
yeah.
I mean, how was that? Was that, you know, incredibly frightening or actually not so, you know, like, just talk about that for a little bit.
Well, you know, being gay and basically having being gay be criminalized in the point in time where I was serving, it was scary because when you're doing your job, it makes you kind of disengage from your fellow soldiers. I wasn't as close to them as I could have been because I was like, oh my God, you know, somebody's going to discover the secret. Somebody's going to discover that I'm gay and get me ran out of the military. And then there goes my college. There goes my life. There goes everything.
Right.
So it was scary in that capacity. Now, you know, people aren't as, you know, unaccepting as you may think. People certainly are not as homophobic as I thought. I ended up coming out to a couple of really close friends of mine when I was in the military.
Uh-huh.
And it was scary.
So they weren't in the military. They were outside of it.
No, they were in the military. Yeah, some of my fellow soldiers.
Interesting.
Yeah. And nobody ever, you know, military terminology busted you out, like, you know, told on you. So nobody ever reported me or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So it was scary, but mostly I was just, you know, trying to live my life. I did 2 deployments as well.
Right.
So I was trying to, you know, to not get killed. And the funny thing about it is that me being gay, once I even came out to my closest friends in the military, it was tertiary,
right.
if even that, to, you know, who I was as right. a person and as a soldier.
So that was 2005. And then what about your family?
I came out to my family like around that time. Came out to my mother over the phone while I was in the military. She did not take it well.
Right.
It took her a very long time to kind of come back around to it. And now she's just like, you know, gay mom of the year.
Really?
You know? Now she's all about it. But
How long?
What's that?
How long did it take?
It took her, I would say that it took a good decade for her to really come around to where she is right now. And, you know, I give a lot of talks on college campuses all across the country. And I have a lot of younger gay kids, you know, ask me, you know, when's the right time to come out? Should I come out to my parents? And I say, you know, it's not always an after school special, and they're not always going to, you know, envelop you in this warm bear hug and
right.
take you out for ice cream afterwards.
Right.
So you kind of have to gauge it. But parents, if they love you, will eventually come around. And my parents came around.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And then, so I'm just going to getting the timeline now. Then the Republican part. The other big coming out in your life.
So the other big coming out, the Republican part, that was recent. That was around maybe April or May of last year. I'll tell you the story.
Yeah.
So I'm in Las Vegas. I'm visiting my very best friend in the world lives in Las Vegas. And I've been thinking about... I started becoming more conservative leaning around 2015, 2016. Mm-hmm. I was just not a fan of Hillary Clinton. To me, she represented...
By the way, before that, would you put yourself on the left, a Democrat, or just not particularly political?
Well, not only was I on the left, I was so far left, I actually protested against Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So I protested for Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal.
Uh-huh.
I was arrested at the White House under the Obama administration protesting Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I was there when Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal got signed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very active and sort of, I wouldn't call that leftist because, you know, we had some Republicans on board as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just got involved with politics at that
point.
But
were you a Democrat?
I was a Democrat.
Right.
And I was a Democrat now that I look back on it. I wasn't a Democrat. It was almost because it was what I was supposed to believe. And it was what everybody around me told me I should believe.
Right.
And I thought that, well, you know, the Republican Party is the party of evil old white men who want to subjugate me, you know, and who want to keep me oppressed. And that's what I thought at the time. And after all this stuff happened around 2015, 2016, when the election started coming around and it was Hillary Clinton, and I just thought that she represented everything that was wrong with the Democratic Party, but I started feeling differently about illegal immigration. That's kind of like my number one issue as a conservative. And I started feeling differently about illegal immigration. I started feeling differently about the liberals and the Democrats. And as a gay man, when Pulse Orlando happened, you know, when a terrorist went into that gay club and killed 49 gays and lesbians, and the response from the Democrats was weaker than I thought that it should have been.
Where were you living at this time?
At this time, I was living in New York.
Right.
So I've been in New York for a while.
Yeah. So you'd moved to New York.
Yeah.
What were you doing?
I was working in journalism and media. Yeah.
So you're really in a very liberal zone.
The bubble. It is the bluest bubble of the bluest bubble.
Yeah.
Still live there right now, and it is still as blue as it's ever been. But I started seeing things differently after Pulse Orlando happened. And I think that for me, when I was protesting against Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, and I was giving these lectures and I was doing all of this stuff, I was very afraid to say what I truly felt, because when you're on the left, there is this pressure to not say what you really feel because you have to fall in line with whatever the left says.
Right.
And I was feeling this pressure. And when I decided to come out was, you know, Pulse Orlando happened. I was starting to feel differently about illegal immigration. And I remember maybe about 15 months ago, I went to Las Vegas to visit my best friend. And I was just sitting and I was like, you know what? If I want to do this, if I want to say that I can be a Republican and I can be conservative, even though I'm black and gay, it has to be a moment. It has to be a media moment, because media moments make impacts. And I know that I'm not the only black gay Republican in America. Was not then, I'm still not now, but I knew I had to make a moment out of it. And that's when I decided to kind of leverage my media connections to do it. I came out via a profile in the Daily Mail, and then that I started being a lot more vocal people on social media saying the things that I wanted to say that mm-hmm. are more in my authentic voice. I started doing a lot of Fox News stuff. Mm-hmm. I got connected with Turning Point USA, and I just, you know, I have become now America's favorite black gay Republican.
You're really out there in every
really
sense.
I'm really out there in every sense,
Let me just go back to I was interested in that policy dimension to it, illegal immigration.
Yes.
So you were saying that became something that you were thinking about a lot after Pulse or before, and then it got more...
I was already thinking about it before. I read a book by Ann Coulter called Adios America that blew my mind wide open.
We always get in trouble with our... But that book does have an absolutely brilliant subtitle.
It does.
Can you remember the subtitle?
Oh, wait a minute. It was Adios America. Oh, God. Is it like Inside the Left's Plan to Turn America into a Third World Hellhole or something like that?
Exactly. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Very good. That was the title. So I read this book and it's really funny because I was getting, as they say, red-pilled. So I got red-pilled.
I've never understood what that is.
Okay,
I'm too old for all this.
So red-pilled is the moment when you realize that, oh, you may be a little bit more conservative-leaning than you thought.
Right, but does that red-pilled term imply that someone did it to you? Like someone gave you a red pill, or is that
what it implies that somebody gave you a red pill either by their knowledge or by work that they've created, like Ann Coulter creating that book.
So were you thinking, oh, I've been red pilled by Ann Coulter? That what you would think?
It wasn't in my terminology at that point in time, but now when I look back to it and that terminology is very popular now, I'm like, oh, that was my red pill moment. That was one of my red pill moments. Pulse Orlando was the biggest one.
So you read the book. What made you read that book if you were on the left? That's interesting to me.
I just had become more interested about illegal immigration. And I had become more interested about the effects that it was having on the country. Uh-huh. And being from Akron, Ohio, and being from a working class black background, I've always been aware of the tension that exists in working class neighborhoods of all colors, but particularly working class black neighborhoods with the legal and illegal Latino immigrant population.
It's interesting because Teslin Figueroa, who's on our show a lot as well, one day perhaps we'll be on together, you know, it's interesting. She was on the left, you know, she was an organizer on the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016. And actually she makes that exact same point. And she describes this process, how the Democrats now have become so kind of captured by the immigration lobby and advocating for those people.
Yeah.
And of course, some of the cases they take up, you could say, without making any judgment on whether or not that's a good idea, what it's meant is that they've actually in many ways abandoned another core part of their constituency, which is working class African Americans.
Well, yeah, and the thing about it is right now, and when you look at what's happening right now with, let's say, the reparations debate, and when I talk to... So here's the thing. I get a lot of crap for being a black conservative. Mm-hmm. Not as much as you think. Not as much as I get from the LGBT for being a gay conservative. They are brutal. They are absolutely brutal. But I think African Americans, and I think some of them will realize that they are basically being replaced by the Democrats for illegal immigration, because black people know that illegal immigration hurts us. It hurts our working class community. It just does. Mm-hmm. And we're aware of this. And the thing about the left is that...
When you say replace, though, that word itself has become incredibly loaded, hasn't it? Because it's part of that language that comes from... It certainly has been... No, I'm not saying it comes from, but it's certainly been used by the most hateful elements of the right. The Charlottesville people and also the recent shooter. You know, they use that language of replace. You don't mean it in that sense.
I meant it in terms of a voting base.
Right.
So I meant it in terms of the Democrats are using... They think that the way to gain a reliable voting block is through Latino Americans is through this illegal immigration thing.
Right.
And so they're looking to replace African Americans as that sort of reliable voting block.
And did you see, and also the working class element of that argument is important. I mean, and I'm just interested why, because it was one of the big changes I've seen, I'm so interested, we kind of point this out every now and again, is Bernie.
Yes.
In 2015, was very much, his language on immigration was very was almost identical to Donald Trump's.
Yeah.
And he was literally going around saying, you know, open borders, that's a Koch brothers thing, bring in all this cheap labor.
Yeah.
No, you know, we don't. And of course, he's just completely abandoned that because he's realized you can't get anywhere in the Democrat Party if you hold that position.
Because they are now.
I was just interested back then when he was saying that, why, given that you were on the left, why didn't you kind of go along with Bernie?
I did vote for Bernie Sanders. I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
In New York State, I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary and did not vote in the presidential election. But, okay, so I have a theory, all right, because I'm a millennial, and I'm a millennial that went through the economic downturn. Mm-hmm. And that economic downturn that happened has left my generation of millennials completely scarred.
Yes.
And I believe that it has turned millennials into two groups. Uh-huh. There's either the group that is mad at the elites that are saying that this was somebody else's fault and they need to pay.
Yeah.
So they need to pay my student loans off.
Yeah.
They need to take care. They need to make college free. They need to socialize medicine. They need to do all these different things. And then there's the other side of millennials, which I think that I fall under, which is like, this sucked and this makes me believe that I have to do this myself. I have to be an entrepreneur. I have to go out there and get it. I have to take responsibility, because I knew after working through that economic downturn that companies generally don't care about people in the way that they used to. So it's like, whatever I'm going to do for myself has to be for myself. And I think that that's what's going on with the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the party. These are people that are absolutely scarred by that economic downturn, and they have decided to blame the elites, blame the 1%, blame anybody but taking the responsibility for themselves.
It's very exciting what you're saying. I'm getting a really great connection of that, because it's like, that brings us back to what we're talking about. That really is what I think of as positive populism, which is that I'm going to have the power. Okay.
Yeah.
Because to a certain extent, you know, I would go along with the elites have screwed you, like, you know, the policies, the economic policies for decades, which the elite pushed forward and the establishment and benefited from, definitely screwed not just millennials, but working people for decades, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, we can all agree about that. But the answer is not the statism of Warren and Bernie Sanders. That's right. So real populism, I think, is you having power, people having power, not being dependent on the establishment, on the. And so I think that's such a profound point you've just made.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, and when I talk about my transition to conservatism, of course, it's about illegal immigration. And I think that there's some nuttiness that's going on with the LGBTQIAK++ that I've referenced a lot in my social media and when I speak. But it's also about the fact that we cannot make this move into socialism
as a society.
It's really
powerful what you just said.
We cannot do that.
That take responsibility point.
You have to.
And
my best friend in the world, and he knows he's my best friend. I never say him by name, but he is practically a socialist. And we argue about this stuff all the time, and I love him to death.
But that's
he's
so
like
funny. That
brother.
Reminds me of Bret Easton Ellis. So he's like Bret Easton Ellis. I had him on The Next Revolution, and he was talking about his book, White. And his... as he described it, his communist millennial boyfriend.
Yeah.
And like, as Brett has become more kind of, the way he described it, like sort of actually just totally repulsed by the kind of crazy anti-Trump derangement that he sees on there. So he's kind of become, now he's seen as this kind of right wing, you know, which he says he's not. But he says it's so funny, the arguments he has with his his communist millennial boyfriend.
And it's really funny. I bet Brett would have a lot to say to you about like how the gay community treats people who've defected,
right,
you know, from the LGBT left, because now we're, you know, we're far right and we're racist and white supremacist and all
That's
this stuff,
right,
which is completely insane to call a black gay man, but they'll say it.
Yes.
But my best friend is practically a socialist, and in his mind, it is somebody else's fault that he took out over $100,000 in student loans to go to a small liberal arts school. Nobody told you to take out those loans.
So do you think, okay, I want to come back to this. It's really interesting. This, you know, I blame you and now you've got to do it for me versus they f*** us over so we can't have that again. We have to stand on our own 2 feet.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Independence versus dependence. The other big feature of the millennial approach to politics and issues these days seems to me is the woke stuff, right?
Oh, God,
so does that layer of stuff map onto that division? In other words, the people who want the government to do everything for them are also the woke people, or is it not as neat as that?
No, I think you have it right. As a former woke warrior myself, or right. wokey, or whatever you want to call them, I think that a lot of the messiness that's going on with the left right now is, I like to say, it's when woke Twitter meets policy.
Right.
So you have a lot of people who become very, very prominent by just saying crazy stuff and in this sort of desperate race to be the wokest. Mm-hmm. But now this stuff is actually starting to infect policy. And this stuff is actually starting to make its way to what is being proposed by our candidates for president.
Right.
Free college, free healthcare for illegal immigrants, intersectionality. God, you know,
Elizabeth Warren announcing her pronouns.
Yeah, Marianne Williamson having white people apologize to black people, you know, at one of her campaign events. And this is kind of like where we're at right now on the left, which is very insane, but also very frightening.
Right.
And I think that what we were talking about earlier about that economic downturn in 2008, it has scarred millennials. And here's the other thing as well. The good thing about the social media era is that you can do it yourself, mm-hmm. and you can decide to get on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and you can create an entire brand for yourself. Mm-hmm. And there are people who have created entire brands for themselves based completely on victimhood, based completely on the fact that white people are evil, that they need to apologize to black people, that, you know, intersectionality is key because as a, you know, heavyset black queer feminist woman that I am somehow more oppressed than somebody else. And on the left, when you see this stuff, and we chuckle about it.
I know. So it is, because it's crazy.
It's nuts. But when you see it in action, it's crazy.
Did you see the thing the other week, the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, their conference? There's so many things in that. But one was the way that they just did the pronouns. And so, you know, I'm Jim Smith from Sacramento, he, him.
He is.
Just
yeah.
like, just so natural. The most normal thing in the world.
Yeah.
But the other one was when they were talking about who's going to get the chance to ask a question.
Yeah.
And they had to kind of explain their victimhood
yeah.
to the person who was holding the microphone. I think I'm getting this right, quote, because not all oppressions are visible.
Yes.
And it was like, oh my God.
And then there was a guy that said that I'm somebody that gets easily triggered by noises and all this stuff. And let me tell you something, Steve. When we get into, and I got a book coming out this fall, and it's about the time that I spent in the military and some of the ideas that I have about the movement right now. But nobody can play the oppression Olympics like me. I get gold every time. I get gold every time. Black, gay, working class, Akron, Ohio, military veteran, served in war. But I don't play that game because to me, that game is not empowering. It doesn't empower me to be a victim.
Okay, let's go back to that divide, the millennial divide. What proportion, just roughly speaking, would you say? I mean, it doesn't feel like it's 50-50. It feels like the majority of millennials fall into that. And I think the data, but I don't know enough about it. The kind of do it all for me camp, because you owe me because you screwed me over. Or is that not right?
I think that it's a little overblown.
Uh-huh.
I think that, I think it was the New York Times or somebody else. They basically did this study that said that the loudest, number one, Twitter and social media only represents like 2% of the population, right?
Yeah.
And so the loudest voices on Twitter really do represent more of a far left fringe than I think we're aware of. Because mm-hmm. most people are not that heavily involved in politics. Most people are just living their lives. Most people that are not white don't go around just like hating white people. I mean, it's just like not worth our time. I think it's a very far left fringe. And what I see is the importance of those voices kind of diminishing because there's nowhere for it to go. And mm-hmm. then what happens is the infighting starts.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see it, and I bring up the LGBT a lot
mm-hmm.
because now in the LGBT, so like I'm a black gay man, but mm-hmm. of course I have all this privilege, right? And I'm oppressing other people. So the fact that I'm a gay...
By the way, what is the argument they make to back that up?
The argument that they make is that, God, you know, because I'm a male, I have all this privilege as a male, and, you know, it overcuts my blackness or my gayness. Like, I don't know. But the idea is that it's all starting to kind of eat itself, right? So everybody tries to shout other people down based on whatever their perceived privilege is.
Yeah.
White gay men are basically, you know, the most evil of the evil in the entire LGBT community, yet all the organizations depend on their money to survive. So I don't entirely know how that works.
The whole thing is not. What about the Trump? We've got all this way into the conversation. I don't think we've used the word Trump yet.
Wow.
What is the Trump? Just going back to when you came out on the conservative side, that was roughly when Trump was getting going. How did that factor into this, one way or the other?
So me coming out last year, and I remember when I first came out, I wanted. So here's the thing: it's really glad that Trump, the name didn't come up until this far in the conversation, because I didn't want my entire conservatism to be defined by Donald Trump, and I still don't. And I am a supporter of the president. I've been on record as saying as I'm a supporter, but I was very wary about that at first. But then one of the members of our esteemed media tried to find an old tweet that I did that where I said offhand, like, oh, Trump is a racist or something like that. This was literally like back in 2015 when I was barely on Twitter. And this person tried to shame me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was when I doubled down publicly on my Trump support, because I'm like, look, this is America.
Yeah.
Okay, over half the population elected this person president. That we can't live in a – if you thought that literally 50-plus million people in this country are just racist white supremacists that elected the president because they hate black people or people of color or whatever, you're being completely ridiculous.
Yes.
And so if you try to shame me for something, I'm literally going to triple down.
Right.
And that is exactly what I did when this person tried to put that out publicly to embarrass me after I'd shared a photo of myself at the White House for a Black History Month event.
So you would say right now you would think of yourself, well, what about that label conservative? You like that term? You're happy with that?
I like conservative.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some people that say conservative, not Republican, because Republican's too loaded.
Yeah.
And then there's some people on the left that says, well, you can be a conservative, but you just can't be a Trump supporter.
Right.
And I'm just like, I'm not going to play this game of trying to be accepted by you, because we both know you're going to move the goalposts.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of black conservatives, and there are a lot of conservatives in general that are out there playing this game about I'm a conservative, but not a Trump supporter. And basically the only thing that they do, they don't talk about anything conservative. They just slam Trump.
I know. That's the whole thing. I mean, that's why, funnily enough, when I think about the language a lot of the time that I observe from the critics, it's often the never Trumpers, those that drive me the most crazy.
Yeah. Just,
they're so kind of virulent in their language.
Yeah.
And there's something, and I keep saying, yeah, okay, but you're the ones whose failure caused this phenomenon. It was your policies that actually led to working class people saying, hang on a second, this trade policy isn't working for us, this immigration policy, this kind of, you know, doing the bidding of the corporations, all that kind of populist rhetoric, and China and whatever, all that didn't work. That's why we've got Trump. So there's no use you now turning around and say, oh, Trump's so ghastly.
I mean, you know, I think that with a lot of them, they like being accepted by the legacy media, because you have to understand, you cannot overestimate the amount of contempt that that our wonderful, you know, New York, D.C. media elite have for the president. And I think that for some of those people that are like, I'm a conservative, but I'm a never Trumper, and oh my God, he's just so this and he's so that, and oh my God, all that's about, you know, wanting to go to the media parties and wanting to be kind of accepted into that crowd.
I think a lot of it, by the way, is aesthetic. You know, they it's not based on policy or substance.
No.
Really. It's like, oh, I can't stand him. My God, look at him. It's what he looks like. Oh, he eats McDonald's. You know what I mean? It's stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's the stuff that attracts the
real people
to him,
yeah,
real
exactly
people
right.
who have actually eaten McDonald's at some point in their life. And it's really funny to not, you know, go too much into Trump, but it's so funny how somebody that is so wealthy has been able to capture the imagination of working people.
Yeah.
And to be able to relate to working people in that way. There's something very special about that.
Yes.
And I don't think that it's explored enough.
I think I totally agree. And one part of it, I think, a theory of is actually the nature of how he got wealthy, which, okay, you can say, well, you know, in the later days, it was the TV show and the brand and whatever. But remember, he started in construction.
Yeah.
And, you can argue about where, how much money he made, whatever, but he spent a lot of time on construction sites.
Yes.
And literally spending time with blue collar workers, with construction workers. Yeah. And I think that's a big part of it. You sort of grew up around those kind of regular working people, rather than, I don't know, someone like, I don't know, Mitt Romney, sort of financial wheeler dealing that no one can really understand. Trump build buildings. I get it. You know, there's a sort of basicness to that.
And these people live in the bubble. And you and I talked a lot about, you know, a couple of these Democratic candidates that are running for president. And it's just like, their contempt for the working person, it comes off of them in waves. You can tell.
Yeah,
you can tell.
That's what I really hate the most.
And when you spend enough time, not just with the candidates, but when you spend enough time on the ground talking about real people, talking with real people, and you get out of the swamp, mm-hmm. and you get out of LA, mm-hmm. and you get out of New York, and you spend time around real people, you mm-hmm. can see who is of the people and who's not.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And the thing that really I feel very strong. You know, I get the same question, are you a Trump supporter or whatever? And I remember in the campaign that came up the times. My immediate response is, okay, whatever. What I'm really telling you is I support Trump supporters.
Yes.
Because these people have been patronized and looked down on and screwed over by establishment politics and politicians for years. And finally, here's someone who's speaking up for them. And good for that.
And
good for him and them.
In defense of the Trump supporter, look, I came out as conservative, black, gay, Republican, all this stuff, probably about 15 months ago. I had something like 135,000 followers over social media. Like, I go to Trump rallies. I meet these people. These people come up to me everywhere I'm at. Nice, kind, genuine.
Yes.
Like, showing love on social media, showing love on the Instagram post, showing love on the Twitter post. I love America. I served America. And I refuse to believe it is antithetical to my very being to believe that 50 plus million Americans are deeply racist just because of who they voted
yeah,
for.
I just never bought it. Well, we're out of time. That was great. We're going to keep talking, though, in various places, I hope.
Absolutely.
Great to see you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in freefall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.